Hi.
Hi. So, what's this book about?
You didn't read this one either?
Well, I was gonna, but I accidentally read something else.
What?
Vogue.
I hated the book, all right? I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it. I mean, it went on and on and on like it was written in a total hurry. If I handed in something like this, there's no way I'd get a good grade on it. I mean, it's boring and it's unorganized. And I only read 30 pages of it anyway.
Well, that was passionate, albeit entirely misinformed.
Who dares follow Miss Kelly's lucid analysis?
It's required reading.
With Tom and Stella.
Episode 103, Never Let Me Go by Kazuo Ishiguro.
Well, as far as the novel was concerned, I have to say, Philip K. Dick hasn't been an influence. I know he's a very great writer, but I've never read him. I have to be honest. I mean, my aim was always, as far as the novel was concerned, to write a story about really how love and friendship fitted into people's lives, particularly as they started to realize that time was short and that mortality was a fact. I was always looking for that, a kind of a metaphor, if you like, for the kind of human existence, the human condition, the fact that, you know, our existence is limited. And so I was always looking for that. What you might call the sci-fi speculative surface of the story was almost like the last thing. It was the last piece of the jigsaw. It was almost like a device to make the thing work, to create this world that seems very strange and distant initially. But then hopefully, you know, the reader, the audience, will start to actually recognize it as their own story. That was the idea. But inevitably then, having chosen this kind of dystopian world, it starts to raise all these issues about you know, biotechnology, perhaps about organ donation. That's fine with me. It's probably fine with everybody else. But I'm not sure if that is at the heart of what we were trying to do. I think we were trying to tell a story about love, friendship, in the face of the bleak fact that we're mortal. I don't know how other people feel about that, but I mean, that was my position when I was writing the novel. The big question, the second question about why don't they escape? I know that this is probably a question a lot of people ask about this movie. When I published the book 5 years ago, a lot of people asked that about the book. I have to take responsibility for this question coming up a lot. And the honest answer is I was never interested in looking at that story of brave slaves who rebelled and escaped. I like those stories. I think there are many of those stories, both in film and in book. I'm fascinated by the extent to which people don't run away. Mm-hmm. And I think if you look around us, that is the remarkable fact. How much we accept what fate has given us. Sometimes it's just passivity. Sometimes it's just simply perspective. You know, we don't have the perspective to think about running away. And ultimately, I suppose, as I suggested when I was answering the earlier question, I was looking for a metaphor for how we face mortality. And we can't really escape from that. We can't escape from the fact that we've only got a limited amount of time. We try. You know, we try and tell ourselves stories. We have religion. We try to do it with children or with our achievements outliving us. But ultimately, it's very difficult to escape. So I wasn't wanting to look at a story about escape. I was wanting to look at how we accept our fate.
Hello and welcome to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, a podcast brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. This podcast is all about books and literature, and each month we take a thorough look at one piece of literature that we've both read and determine whether it is required reading. Well, it's anyone's guess whether I am a carer, whether I am a donor, whether Tom is a carer or a donor, or who could our possibles be? But you can wonder all of that as we talk about this book. I am Stella, and I am here with my good friend, Tom Panarese.
Hey, hey.
Yeah. All right. Is your heart doing okay, young man?
I think I'm okay for now. So.
Yes, we'll find out as we continue.
Yes.
Whether we made it or not.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we're. I mean, I did this to us, obviously, so I have no one to blame but myself. But it was a book that I saw on a particular list, and I thought, you know what, I should give it a go, and bought it. And I think this podcast, it's one reason we do it is because we love literature. Another reason is just so we can have an excuse to hang out. A third reason is that we can use it as an excuse to whittle down our TBR piles.
This is true.
And so I am using that third reason here today. What is your history with this? I mean, I've heard you mention this book a couple times on previous episodes. What is your history with Never Let Me Go?
So this is the second time I've ever read it. I first read it about, it might be almost 20 years ago. Yeah, like I want to say 2006 or so. So my wife and I were part of a book club among friends that she met through work and stuff. And this actually had been her pick. Like, you know, somebody picked the book each month, and she had been going and looking at everything. And she had read some of Ishiguro's other work. And we actually have a copy of one of his novels, When We Were Orphans, I believe it's called. And then I have a couple of the more recent ones, which I still have to read. So knowing that he was, you know, and the premise sounded really cool, she said. And then she read it while we were on vacation. It was just like, it knocked her for a loop and everything. And then I read it as well after she was done with it. And it's always stayed with me as you know, when books come up that you really remember. So if you weren't going to do it, I was eventually going to get around to it anyway. So this is, I've had it for years and I hadn't gone back and read it, and I have never seen the film either. So this was almost like reading it the second time was almost like reading it the first time. Although as we went through the book, I started to remember more and more and more.
It's funny you say that, because I've been seeing isn't technically a meme, though it's like repeated. So it seems like it's a meme, but it's on Instagram. It's a video. So I don't know what that is necessarily called, but where people are being told, quote, it's like a fantastic thing that they're going to experience memory loss or something. And the physician is like apologetic, obviously, but the person's like super excited and then they run to their bookshelf. So, you know, they can experience their beloved books for the first time again. So that's what that made me think of. Well, yeah, your poor SO, I mean, thinking that this was going to be a fanciful and light read, taking it to the beach, and it is anything but.
Yeah.
I had first experienced the film when it had come out. I recall renting it from Redbox. And I think I primarily did because of Andrew Garfield and probably secondarily Keira Knightley, but I think primarily Andrew Garfield, even though right now I'm a big Carey Mulligan fan, especially after Promising Young Woman. So I recall like watching this, and for the most part, it's fine, as in like emotionally you're pretty stable. But the last bit of it, what is like super wrecking and destroying. And I think it's one of the saddest things that I've ever watched. So this is the first time I'm reading it. And I wondered how it was going to go. I also considered, do I want to rewatch the film? But then I went on YouTube and did a little, you know, Tommy and Kathy, like a little research, and saw one of those videos of like their story. And as I was watching, I was like, yeah, I don't need to relive that pain. Reading it was quite enough. So this is my first time reading it, second time experiencing it. And it is interesting to get inside Kathy's head, whereas the film, obviously you can, I don't think there was a narration. It's been a little while, but you know, you're just reading body language and facial cues and things like that. So you don't necessarily get insight into what somebody is thinking. Where even I think Kathy is a bit of a, there are some hidden things I think with her too, which we can definitely talk about. But yes, so it was hard, but I think because I was prepared, it wasn't as hard as it could have been. So I think your SO experienced it probably worse than I did, for sure. Okay, well, I will get into the real life of the author, Kazuo Ishiguro. And thank you to Wikipedia. He was born in Nagasaki, Japan on the 8th of November, 1954. And his father is a physical oceanographer. And in 1960, the family moved to Guildford, Surrey in the UK, as his father was invited for research at the National Institute of Oceanography. He did not return to Japan until 1989, nearly 30 years later, when he participated in the Japan Foundation Short-Term Visitors Program. In an interview with Kenzaburo Oe, Ishiguro stated that the Japanese settings of his first two novels were imaginary. Quote, I grew up with a very strong image in my head of this other country, a very important other country to which I had a strong emotional tie. In England, I was all the time building up this picture in my head, an imaginary Japan, end quote. And Never Let Me Go takes place in the UK rather than in Japan. He's been described as a British Asian author. Let's see here. He attended Stoughton Primary School and then Woking County Grammar School in Surrey. He sang solos as a choir boy. These are all very specific. He enjoyed music as a teenager, listening to the likes of Leonard Cohen, Joni Mitchell, and Bob Dylan, which we can talk about musical inspiration that appears in this novel. He also learned guitar and wrote some songs. And originally, he thought he would become a professional songwriter. He says, quote, for me, there's always been big overlap between fiction and song. My style as a novelist comes substantially from what I learned writing songs. The intimate first person quality of a singer performing to an audience, for instance, carried over for me into novels, as did the need to approach meaning subtly, sometimes by nudging it into the spaces between the lines, end quote. After finishing school in 1973, he took a gap year and traveled through the U.S. and Canada, writing a journal and sending demo tapes to record companies. He also worked as a grouse beater, a practice of driven grouse shooting at Balmoral Castle. It's in Balmoral Castle where the royal family goes. Ishiguro later reflected on his ephemeral songwriting career, saying, quote, I used to see myself as some sort of musician type, but there came a point when I thought, actually, this isn't me at all. I'm much less glamorous. I'm one of those people with corduroy jackets with elbow patches. It was a real come down, end quote. In 1974, he began studies at the University of Kent at Canterbury, graduating in 1978 with a Bachelor of Arts honors in English and philosophy. After spending a year writing fiction, he resumed his studies at the University of East Anglia, where he studied with Malcolm Bradbury and Angela Carter on the UEA Creative Writing course, gaining the degree of Master of Arts in 1980. His thesis became his first novel, A Pale View of Hills, published in 1982, and he actually gained British citizenship in 1983. So the list of his novels are as follows, and then I'll talk about some awards that he got. A Pale View of the Hills, as I mentioned, in 1982. An Artist of the Floating World in 1986. The Remains of the Day in 1989, also known as a well-known film. The Unconsoled in 1995, When We Were Orphans, that Tom mentioned in 2000, the one we're talking about today in 2005, Never Let Me Go, The Buried Giant in 2015, and Claire and the Sun, which I recommend in 2021, but also that is a sad book, which apparently is being made into a film, or so they say. With awards, he did win the Nobel Prize in Literature in 2017 with the motivation in novels of great emotional force. He has uncovered the abyss beneath our illusory sense of connection with the world. He was seen as a surprise choice by many observers, but the choice was generally well received. In response to receiving the award, Ishiguro stated, quote, "It's a magnificent honor, mainly because it means that I'm in the footsteps of the greatest authors that have lived." So that's a terrific commendation. The world is in a very uncertain moment. Oh, well, this is 2017 and it feels like that in 2025. And I would hope all the Nobel Prizes would be a force for something positive in the world as it is at the moment. I'll be deeply moved if I could in some way be part of some sort of climate this year in contributing to some sort of positive atmosphere at a very uncertain time. I mean, he has won many awards and have many distinctions, but I think I'll switch over to Never Let Me Go just so we can focus in on that. So Never Let Me Go continues to receive acclaim beyond 2005 among many critics and their lists during and after its release. According to The Greatest Books, a site that aggregates book lists, it is the 277th greatest book of all time. In 2019, the novel ranked fourth on The Guardian's list of the 100 best books of the 21st century. In 2024, the novel ranked ninth on the New York Times list of the 100 best books of the 21st century, which was, in fact, the list that encouraged me to buy it. Ishiguro has stated that the novel began with a plot involving a nuclear bomb, but that he then began to wonder, quote, what the 20th century might have looked like if the incredible developments that took place in nuclear physics, culminating in the creation of the atom and hydrogen bombs, had taken place instead in the field of biology, specifically in cloning, end quote. Ishiguro said he began writing the novel in the 90s without a clear idea of his intentions. In 2001, listening to a radio broadcast on biotechnology, he suddenly decided to direct his new novel to deal with the sadness of the human condition, as he calls it. He also proposed to deal with some of the oldest questions in literature. What does it mean to be human? What is the soul? What is the purpose for which we've been created? And should we try to fulfill it? In contemporary literature, author Anne Whitehead highlights the novel's focus on healthcare as particularly thought-provoking, with Kathy's status as a carer defining much of her adult life. Whitefield writes, Kathy's preoccupations with professional success and with minor inconsistencies in the system mean that she is not addressing either her own imminent death or the larger inequities and injustices at work, and wonders, is caring viewed in this light a form of labor that is socially valuable because Kathy is making a positive difference to others, preventing agitation, or given the political resonances of Ishiguro's choice of word here, is it a means of preventing resistance and unrest? And John Mullen speculates that the novel's modern setting is calculated to have a defamiliarizing effect. While this novel measures carefully the passing of time, its chronology, we soon realize, is removed from any historical reality that we can recognize. Mark Romanek directed a 2010 film adaptation of Never Let Me Go, starring, as I mentioned, Carey Mulligan as Kathy, Andrew Garfield as Tommy, and Keira Knightley as Ruth. In Japan in 2014, the Horipro agency produced a stage adaptation. In 2016, under the same title, Tokyo Broadcasting System Television aired a TV drama adaptation set in Japan. And a television series adaptation was optioned at FX to be produced by DNA TV, Searchlight Television, and FXP. With Andrew McDonald, Alan Reich, Mark Munden, Melissa Iqbal, and Alex Garland, you should know his name, executive producing. It would have premiered on Hulu in the United States, Star in other territories, and Star Plus in Latin America. However, in February 2023, it was announced that FX had canceled the series before production began. And there is a stage adaptation, or was, in English by Suzanne Heathcote that was presented at the Rose Theater Kingston in September 2024 and subsequently at other theaters in England.
Hmm. I'll say that I remember He Did Remains of the Day, although I remember the Anthony Hopkins film more than I, and right. With Emma Thompson. Yep. More than I, there's some Merchant Ivory production because it like was up for a ton of Academy Awards back in, was it 93? And Mark Romanek directed this. Mark Romanek, who directed the Nine Inch Nails video Closer. And I want to say he also directed the video for Bedtime Stories by Madonna, but don't quote me on that. Oh. But no, I just remember, yeah, that was the closer, of course, being I Want to Blank You Like an Animal, et cetera, from a downward spiral. Yeah. He's one of those. And I didn't know I'm not as familiar with his filmography as I am with, like, say, David Fincher, who also came from music videos.
Well, he was a bit more sensitive, I would say, than David Fincher's films. So,
Romantic is kind of warped, though. So,
yeah. Well, no, I mean he was sensitive with the movie.
Okay.
Whereas his music videos might be intense.
Yeah.
But then Fincher, the music videos might be intense, but also his films are intense. I think that's it. Yeah. All I have to say about that. Do you have any other?
No. I did not know. And the only other thing is, I really can't picture it. I'm sure Andrew Garfield is very, very good.
Yeah.
I don't want to call him an underrated actor because he's gotten a lot more recognition for other roles other than the two Spider-Man movies he did. But I don't picture him as Tommy because I don't picture Tommy as being as attractive as Andrew Garfield is. But maybe that's just me.
I don't know. I can't help you because I saw the film first that it's a bit colored for me. So. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Do the plot.
Yeah, time for a plot synopsis. Kathy H. describes herself as a carer for donors. She reminisces about her time at Hailsham, a boarding school where the teachers are known as guardians. The children are closely monitored and are instructed on the importance of producing art and staying healthy. Smoking is taboo, but sex is a-okay. The student's best art is selected by Madame for a mysterious gallery. Kathy develops a close friendship with two other students, Ruth C. and Tommy D. Kathy develops a fondness for Tommy, looking after him when he is bullied and having private talks with him. However, Tommy and Ruth form a relationship instead. At one of the school's sales, where the students are allowed to buy items from the outside world, Kathy acquires a cassette tape containing songs by Judy Bridgewater, a fictional singer, including a song about a woman saying to her lover, quote, "Baby, never let me go," end quote. Kathy dances to the song, imagining that she is a mother and singing the song to her child. Kathy discovers Madame looking at her from the corridor, crying, then rushing away. Eventually, Kathy loses the tape, and the students joke that it has gone to Norfolk, where they believe all lost things go. Towards the end of their time at Hailsham, the guardian Miss Lucy tells the students that they are being raised to donate organs to others, like save your siblings, and it is predetermined that they will die young. Miss Lucy is removed from the school as a result. The students passively accept their fate. Ruth, and I will say that she kind of dances around. It's not that blunt. Ruth, Tommy, and Kathy move to the cottages when they are 16 years old. It is the first time they are allowed to explore the outside world, but they mostly keep to themselves. Ruth and Tommy are still together, and Kathy has some sexual relationships with other men. They have housemates who are not from Hailsham. They all struggle with social skills and are revealed to be clones. Two older housemates tell Ruth that they have seen a possible for Ruth, an older woman who resembles her and thus could be the woman from whom she was cloned. The five of them go on a trip to see her, and the older clones discuss a rumor they have heard, that a couple can have their donations deferred for a few years if they can prove that they are in love. They believe that the privilege is for Hailsham students only, and so wrongly expect that the others know how to apply for it. They find the possible in an office, but the resemblance to Ruth is only superficial. Ruth voices angrily that they must all be cloned from lower social classes. She calls them trash. During the trip, Kathy and Tommy leave to look for a copy of the music cassette tape that Kathy had lost at Hailsham. Tommy's recollection of the tape and desire to find it make clear the depth of his feelings for Kathy. They find the tape, and Tommy shares with Kathy a theory that the reason Madame collected their art was to determine which couples were truly in love, citing a guardian who had said that their art revealed their souls. They do not tell Ruth of the found tape or of Tommy's theory about the deferral. When Ruth finds out about these, she attempts to drive a wedge between Tommy and Kathy, telling Kathy that even if Ruth and Tommy were to split up, Tommy would never enter into a relationship with Kathy because of her sexual history. A few weeks later, Kathy appears to become a carer, meaning that she will not see Ruth or Tommy for about 10 years. Ruth's first donation goes badly, and her health deteriorates. Kathy hears and becomes Ruth's carer, and both are aware that Ruth's next donation would probably be her last. I should also say that they kind of patch up their relationship here because it was rough. And that's one of the reasons why Kathy left. Ruth suggests that she and Kathy take a trip and take Tommy with them. During the trip, Ruth expresses regret for keeping Kathy and Tommy apart. By the way, the trip is to see a beached or like a partially beached ship that everyone's super excited about. During the trip, Ruth expresses regret for keeping Kathy and Tommy apart, basically saying that that's the worst thing that she's ever done and asks for forgiveness. Attempting to make amends, she hands them Madame's address, urging them to seek a deferral, even though Tommy has already started donating. Shortly afterward, Ruth makes her second donation and completes, a euphemism for dying. Kathy becomes Tommy's carer, and they finally enter a relationship. Encouraged by Ruth's last wishes, they go to Madame's house to attempt to defer Tommy's fourth donation, taking new artwork from Tommy to support their claim that they are in love. The clones are invited in by Madame and also meet Miss Emily, their former head teacher, who lives with her. The two women reveal that deferrals do not exist. Miss Emily then explains to Kathy and Tommy that people started making clones for medical sciences and research after the war, presumably the Second World War. These initial clones were brought up in terrible conditions, and Hailsham was part of a small movement to make people see clones as human and thus deserving of a cultural education and humane upbringing. The gallery was meant to convey to the outside world that the clones are in fact normal human beings with a soul. However, a series of experiments where a professor in Scotland tried to create genetically superior clones resulted in a public opinion turning against the overall movement, leading to Hailsham being shut down. Upon further questioning, Miss Emily reveals that Miss Lucy wanted to change Hailsham by raising the clones with full knowledge of what was going to happen to them, but the proposal was rejected because Miss Emily felt that this would shatter the rich and happy upbringing, which was the entire point. As Kathy and Tommy are leaving, Madame tells Kathy that when she saw Kathy dancing to the song Never Let Me Go in Hailsham, she imagined Kathy trying to hold on to an older, kinder world, but one that could never come back. Tommy and Kathy take the back roads to the donation center. On the way, Tommy has Kathy stop the car, and he runs out into a field, a muddy field. He screams and shouts as he did back in Hailsham. He had a bit of an anger management situation when he was younger, till Kathy comes and calms him down. Tommy receives a notice for his fourth donation, a major event since it is widely believed that either all clones complete after their fourth or are left in a horrible state where they are simply used for more and more donations till they die. Tommy, angry when facing his death, distances himself from Kathy and eventually tells her that he wants a new carer. Kathy resigns as Tommy's carer. Oh, it's making me sad just talking about it. But still visits him till he is handed over to his new carer. The novel ends after Tommy completes. Kathy has gotten her notice for her first donation at the end of the year. She drives up to Norfolk and stares at a garbage dump, contemplating everything she remembers and everything she lost. Such happy, bright times. Here we are. Tom, did you like Never Let Me Go the second time around?
Yeah, I really did. It took me a while to read because, like, I just, you know, like when you've read it once, you on some level know what's coming and you're like, do I really want to go through this again? Because one of the things about the book, it's hard to recommend this book to anybody without talking about the cloning because it's not revealed until like a third of the way in or so, like until like, you know, so it's not like, so it's almost like a twist in the first mm-hmm. half of the novel. And I, whenever I recommend this book, I say like, I don't want to reveal that because I want to see like what, you know, somebody coming into it. But yeah, so even going in new and knowing that I was like, you know, I was very attached to these characters and this book is painful. In a good way, you know, not in a, it's painful to read because it's so bad. It's painful because it's just so heavily, just it's hard to come away from this with any feeling except just an emptiness and a sadness.
Sadness indeed. Yeah. You know, we're recording late, obviously. And Tom had asked, you know, are you ready to go? Last week, I think it was.
Yeah.
And I was reading a nonfiction book about the history of the world and eight plagues. And I said, no, I haven't even started. But it sounded like Tom was already finished. And then this week, I think I said, like, oh, I'm nearly there. They're in, like, they're talking about Norfolk or something. And then Tom's like, oh, they're in Norfolk for me right now. And I thought, Tom, haven't you already finished this? So now it makes sense that Tom was taking his time as he was reading it. I too enjoyed it. It took some getting used to how Kathy writes, in that she will be talking about, so she kind of hits three different timelines as she's talking, and you have to keep track of all of them. Mm-hmm. So she will talk about the way back, because she tries to go in chronological order, but she will also be mentioning, oh, like Ruth and I talked about this recently, or Tommy and I talked about this recently. So that's obviously the future. And then you have her own present. And then I should say there's a fourth one. There's a, because she will say something like dot, 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 the, I don't know, the fields, which I'll talk about later, you know, and like we'll mention it. So you have to, you do have to take care. It's not necessarily stream of conscience, but I will say that you just have to keep track of what timeline she's talking about. And it, I don't necessarily agree with the formatting where it's almost like she creates unnecessarily her own pauses or her own cliffhangers, because she'll be like, I didn't expect what happened next. Paydrick, what happened next? What? And I'm like, why are you doing this? Couldn't you have just gone on to a new paragraph? You didn't have to do that. So those are the only things that you have to get used to, as well as I might have had some qualms with.
Yeah, I took it as her like being in the room with you and having and telling you a story. And people, when they're telling a story this long, don't always naturally stay on the straight path, and very often go off on tangents, as we as podcasters know. But no, really, like, and I really appreciated that, because it was like she was telling, like she was sitting in the room with me and telling me her story and narrating the story, as opposed to, and I don't think is, you're, I think you're right. It's not necessarily a stream of consciousness. I think it's just a, almost like a conversation. Some of the chapter breaks, you're right, it was a little bit cliffhanger, right? You know, and that sort of stuff. But if that's me having a qualm with it, it's more of a nitpick than anything else. But I liked her tone. I liked Ishiguro's style, because he really established a mood through the whole book that was very, weighed very heavily, but didn't feel so crushing that you didn't want to keep going because you just couldn't take it anymore. And I thought he did that with a good amount of balance, and it's hard to pull off, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay. Well, Kathy introduces herself as, got many of these discussion questions from the publisher of Penguin themselves, so thank you very much. Kathy introduces herself as an experienced carer. She prides herself on knowing how to keep her donors calm, quote, even before fourth donation, end quote, on page 3. How long does it take for the meaning of such terms as donation, carer, and completed to be fully revealed? Is that intentional? And, well, I shouldn't say, because that's obviously it is intentional, but how does it sort of change the novel in that it's not revealed right away?
I think it works really well in the novel that you can, like, because you're kind of curious as to what's going on here with these kids at this special school. This came out in the early 2000s, right? So
yeah, 2005.
Yeah. So, you know, but there was a lot of talk and a lot of hype around another book that tended to take place at a school with a bunch of special children in it, and it wasn't the X-Men. So I mean, I wonder, like, I don't know if he did that on purpose or not, but it was just kind of like, you know, it leads you in. And again, like, if she's talking to you, sometimes people do when they're telling something about themselves or they're talking about something maybe in their industry or something that has a fair amount of jargon in it, they will use it sometimes without defining it. And then you have to either stop them and ask for it or you have to figure out through the context clues of the conversation. And the way she narrates it, it's almost like she's considering the fact that maybe we already know what the whole cloning thing is to some degree or something, like, you know, like as if we were like kind of in the world of that. But I mean, I think I might, and I might be just be kind of like digging a little too deep here, but I did like the fact that it's what all these things mean start to trickle out. And when you get to what Ruth reveals, it does start to click into place. And I like the fact that she never loses the jargon. She never says dies, I think, through the entire book as far mm-hmm. as any of the of her compatriots or friends go. I think it's always completed. And I'm being honest, I think that that word for how they go is a brilliant way to get across kind of the coldness of all of this, the clinicalness of all of it. And I thought that him kind of pulling it out here and there and getting us into the world and then us learning about it and us seeing it in it, because it's a slow book. And him doing that slowly, I think really, really worked.
Yeah, and I think you hold on until you find out, what are these terms? What's going on? What are these? Why are they special? Why are they in this home? That sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it is, it was my next question. I think it sort of answers your question as well, because she is directly addressing us. She says things like, I don't know how it was where you were, but at Hailsham, we used to have some form of medical every week. And she thinks that maybe we might envy her having been at Hailsham. So potentially she is speaking to us as if we were also clones. Mm-hmm. And so assuming that knowledge that, you know, you understand what these terms mean. So I don't need to define them. But for people that are on the outside as we are, creates, definitely some suspense.
Yeah. Well, and it tracks, because if you think about it, they don't interact with a lot of people from the outside throughout the novel. There's like just a handful of them. So if you want to assume the role of the person who she's sitting here talking to, it's either another donor at whatever hospital she's in, or it's her carer, right? So, yeah.
Kathy tells the reader how you were regarded at Hailsham, how much you were liked and respected, had to do with how good you were at creating. What were Hailsham's administrators trying to achieve in attaching such a high value to creativity? I know the plot said one thing, but as we were reading, what were you thinking about all of this and how they got tokens? Because, you know, some of their art was taken back, and also some of their art and things were put into the sales, all of that stuff.
Before the cloning aspect of, or before the donation aspect of it is revealed, it just makes them sound like they were at a special school. So there's a self-worth involved in creating and finding that about yourself. And they put a lot of emphasis on it because I think it's just them trying their best to be kind and show these kids that you're special, you know, that there's something about you that has been caused you to be an outcast perhaps. And, you know, and then, so we're going to help you find something about yourself and feel that self-worth. And then the token is just kind of like that's a pedagogical thing. Like where, you know, the kids do get tokens for things in elementary school. It's one of those practices we've seen people say the research supports it. The research is terrible about it, yada, yada, yada. So that actually didn't throw me. And it does kind of teach personal responsibility. And it also gives them a chance to have things that, possessing things does not make you human, but at the same time, there is something to humanity about the fact that you have things that you own or have that you hold dear. And that's another aspect of it. They really, you know, we can get into the soul. They really were trying to make them feel like they were truly human. Mm-hmm. And the information about how they're viewed upon by the outside world is not very revealed because they're deliberately keeping them separated.
Yeah, and I guess the perception is that they are these creatures or these things because Madame, she's horrified because Ruth was the one to tell Kathy, like, I think she's scared of us. And then it's true. She very much doesn't want to touch them as she's walking past and seems frightened. And even at the very end, Miss Emily reveals that, yeah, she thought they were, she doesn't say gross or disgusting. It's hard to knowing that there's some sort of creation and I guess there's something innately wrong about that they weren't able to look at them like a human. And so I think, which is good for the educators, because I think even though we might, I don't know, our stomachs might turn at something, or we might have some sort of innate bias towards something, we hopefully, good educators, constantly are fighting, you know, against that sort of thing and trying to help the children. And so I think this is true of what's happening here, that they might have some sort of they feel the way the public does, but are trying to help the students as much as they can. And so that's what these drawings are like. I have to say that I think that this is a, not necessarily a foil, but it's like a good partner book with Frankenstein.
Oh yeah, no, that's a really good point.
Because it just feels very similar. And you know, you feel like some of these beats kind of are in line with one another. And I kind of was considering about, you know, what is the nature of the soul, and do these clones have souls? And I feel because they're living and breathing and, you know, they're interacting with people and they're curious, like, I feel like they do have souls.
Yeah.
But I think part of it is it's just easier for humanity to look down upon them and think that they're not human, to make themselves feel better about what they're actually doing, since they're organ harvesting these children.
Yeah, it detaches himself from the responsibility on some level, or their culpability or whatever the word is. And I'm with you. I mean, they're living, they certainly would have a soul, right? Because they're people, like, you know, you have grown these people. And I, you know, with the reveal about how Hailsham is like, was kind of an experiment, you know, and was a very humane way to do it. I can't even begin to think of children being quote unquote born and raised to adulthood, because they have to be adults in order to start the donations.
Yeah.
In what facilities and under what conditions, and what psychologically does that do to those people?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, what are they like psychologically? Because we see these kids are totally like, for as much social interaction to get between each other, they're completely socially awkward. You know, they have a lot of skills out in the world. I can't imagine what it'd be like to be raised at a much terrible place.
I think Ishiguro does a great job in setting that up, because we wonder what the Hailsham experiment is, but then as you're talking about it and that it quote unquote failed and why it failed, on the other side, you're like starting to question, if that was an experiment, what was the standard? And why did the experiment fail? Yeah. Which I'll ask now, like, why do you think, beyond the mad scientist, because it seems so revolutionary. Why is this so hard? Like, why is it easier to potentially, I don't know, beat children or put them in really deplorable conditions or not feed them? Like, I'm just imagining, it's like neglect and abuse is basically what I'm imagining. Why is that easier than treating them with humanity and teaching them and loving them?
I'm trying to think like this type of person, because I know, like, okay, so kind of like starting from the end of Hailsham and working backward, you know, like, the guy's basically doing a eugenics experiment up in Scotland, right?
Yeah.
And that becomes, so for people who are like so opposed to something like Hailsham and treating people like humans, and have a real sort of like streak for basing their view of things on hate, there would be misogynists and bigots and things like that. The exception, it's always the exception that proves the rule. like you could have like, you know, misogynists are like this, right? You know, like you have 99 out of 100 women succeed at something. There's one woman who does not or gets into some sort of trouble, and that's their justification for their misogyny, especially if it's like a policy or taking something away, right? You know, it's the, you know, whereas if you push it back at them, they're like hashtag not all men. And this is kind of like what they do here. It's like clearly somebody was looking for a reason to shut down places like Hailsham, mm-hmm. because they were uncomfortable with having to accept people that they did not think were on the same level as they were. And the minute that happened, they were like, oh, nope, this is all evil. We got to shut it down because the exception proved the rule. So that's where I'm like, okay, I could see that happening. Now, why do they think these, why would they raise these people like this? Again, it's just kind of like a, you were talking about how new people have like innate biases and prejudices and things. And I think there's just the type of people who it's very easy to lean into that or detach themselves from thinking of these people as anything but organ donors, right? Living organ donors. And, you know, because even Emily and Madame like struggle with the good of their mission and the fact that these they still think of these kids as subhuman, right? So they're struggling. It's a really nuanced take too. I thought it was really well done. But yeah, so I just get kind of like, if I'm trying to think of one of these people, it's just like I can other them and think of them as other and less than, and I don't have to worry about it. And I don't have to worry about where my money's going. Like, and all those like really sick political thoughts that even thinking about how that could happen makes me feel dirty. So.
Yeah. I will say, I feel like the groundskeeper at the cottages treated them pretty normally. He kind mm-hmm. of, cause he was a curmudgeon through and through, but he interacted with them and he stole their porn magazines. So I think he cared about, you know, the kids and their future. But he was kind to Tommy cause he gave him, one of his black notebooks mm-hmm. and I think he helped Kathy with something, but I cannot recall. We didn't know too much about him, but I just wonder, like, was he already kind of on the edge of society and wasn't necessarily, you know, so it's, what is that saying that someone who's kind of already on the outs, you know, is the best person or relates the most easiest to the people who are being shoved out. But yeah, it's hard to consider the things that these kids could be going through, if not at Hailsham, which I don't think that novel should be written.
No.
I'd probably get through one chapter and that would be enough. But yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of like, well, I would just wonder, like, sometimes when you see people who are on, I'm not trying to sound condescending to just people who are janitors or like, you know, like kind of that level of working class, but like, there should be a camaraderie or some sort of recognition of somebody who is there with you. And like you have, there should be empathy there. And maybe that's what he's feeling, because very often the way that somebody who is should feel that empathy hates the other person is because they're being told by the person way above them to hate them, right? You know, it's a whole thing that's not even in here. But we've discussed it in other things where there's like totalitarian states, or we've discussed it in other dystopian novels and stuff. But like the fact that this guy shows a little bit of empathy for them is very nice, because there's not a ton of true hope in the book, and that is one of the few moments.
Let's talk about perspective.
Sure.
We like to talk about narration. So Kathy's narration is the key to the novel's disquieting effect. First person narration establishes a kind of intimacy between narrator and reader. Cough, cough, Jane Eyre. What is it like having direct access to Kathy's mind and feelings? How would the novel be different if narrated from Tommy's point of view or Ruth's or Miss Emily's, or I would even say a combination? And as my follow-up that I added, do you trust that Kathy is fully honest with the readers?
I'll tackle your second question first.
Please.
I do.
Okay.
Because I because throughout the book, she even if she's very flawed, she does try to be a very nice person and does try to be an honest person. And I get that this is her, to her, the best of her ability, giving everybody a fair shake and doing her best to tell things as accurately as she can remember. So I think we can trust her because that's what she's trying to show. And her role as a carer later on, like, kind of feeds into that. Now, when you go into, like, Ruth or Tommy, Tommy's narration, I think, would come off as, like, much more innocent and perhaps naive in a lot of places. Maybe very much more sad because he was a victim a lot of times, especially at Hailsham. Ruth, I think Ruth would might be, up until a point, might be one of the more unreliable narrators until she reveals it, like, if she had any revelation about, you know, because she doesn't really come to that revelation about things, or what she has a conversation with Kathy, until she's at the very, very end, right? So it would be a narration. It would be like a deathbed confession. And I don't know if I would enjoy that as much. You know?
Yeah.
And such. And I don't know if it would ring completely true, or if it would be hollow because she's just trying to get something off her chest before she goes. Emily, that would be interesting because that would be where you're seeing somebody struggle with their prejudice.
Yeah.
So
it would feel, if Emily were, it would feel like Testaments. Is that what it's called?
The sequel to The Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah,
yeah.
When we had an aunt, being the narrator, I feel like it would feel like that. I, you know, as someone who dabbles in romance, I don't read too much of it. I
no.
Tom rolled his eyes so hard that one of his eyeballs popped out of his head. I almost wanted a triple POV, you know, to see this. It's impossible given the how it's written because of the different timelines and things, but just to have people kind of go back and see what was actually happening. Because my biggest question was about the romance between Kathy and Tommy, because it's so it's just so weird. I think that they're not together. Like, how does Ruth even slip in there? Because Kathy is the one who, like, helps him. She's the one who cares about the bullying, and, like, they create a connection. Like, Ruth is not really even a part of that. And then all of a sudden, Ruth and Tommy are together. But you kind of understand at the very at the bus stop, I think it was, where they're having a conversation where she said, you know, if we ever broke up, Tommy's not going to get together with you because you're promiscuous. And because that seems like a lie and seems weird, like, 'cause other people are sleeping around too. And that's also terrible, 'cause later on Ruth in her whole confession is like, I slept around with people too while I was with Tommy. I'm like, okay, that doesn't just seem like a terrible person right now. But because she's telling her that, I then was thinking, she's been lying to Tommy for a very long time, probably telling her that, like, Kathy has no interest in you.
Yeah.
Because there are those moments of stillness that Tommy is with Kathy, which become fewer and far between as they get older, when he's with Ruth, where he'll just sit and they'll, you know, have a conversation, but then there'll be silence and he'll be looking at her. So you can tell that there's something going on, but no one makes it so frustrating because you're like, why is no one making a jump? But it's because they've been told, you know, this misinformation. So it'd be nice to, or, well, it wouldn't be nice, but that would be interesting to see what she told Tommy about Kathy, and when. The only reason why I don't fully believe that she's not necessarily, like, honest, but completely transparent, is that she never really talks about her feelings with Tommy. And I feel like that would be maybe the time to do it. Like, she doesn't even say, it's very matter of fact. how she explains that, oh yeah, Tommy and Ruth are together and, you know, they'll do this arm touching thing. Like, she just presents that fact very clinically. I don't know if this is because of her role as a carer and taking notes, which we know that they have to do daily logs and things like that. But she does not ever reveal that this was a hard time for me. You know, I loved Tommy. Like, none of that ever pops through. So it's almost as if you don't, if you're not someone who is like picking up on hints, when Ruth has her whole thing at the end about I kept you two apart, like, you might have been very confused, like, what you talking about? Hopefully you were picking up on things. But yeah, that's the only thing that I wish I could have heard what she was thinking and feeling there. Because after, when they finally get together and establish a relationship, I think she is more transparent about it. And you know, she feels hurt that he's pulling away, and but is unsure how to deal with that. But it's just, as a kid looking back, she doesn't tell us. So that's the only time.
Yeah, I'm thinking about, because she is kind of stoic through a lot of it, or she's very steady, as opposed to Tommy, who is has a lot of emotional outbursts, and you know, and Ruth, who is emotional in a different way. So she's like between the two of them. And, you know, there are a lot of people out there who can tell you that they've had long-term relationships and friendships with members of the opposite sex, if they're hetero, or somebody who could be a romantic partner. Well, you know, I'm not going to hetero, you know, it could be hetero or not hetero or whatever. But like, take me for instance, I've had friendships with women going back to high school, right? And we have been friends for many, many years. And somewhere back there was the possibility of that, and I probably completely missed signals and stuff like that. But if that's kind of how I took it with Ruth and, not Ruth, Ruth and Tommy, Kathy and Tommy, where one of maybe they did pick up on it, but there was also the whole thing of like, maybe that ship has sailed, or maybe like, you know, or, you know, it's not the promiscuity, it's like her attitude toward like what she wanted out of things like sex. Mm-hmm. Would that jive with Tommy maybe wanting a relationship? Like, there's a lot of complicated feelings and emotions that kind of come with that. And Ruth probably knew that, and that's why she was being manipulative. And I just have to laugh because one of my best friends from high school is named Kathy. And we did date for like just a little bit in high school, but it was just kind of funny. I'm like, you know, so I'm just like, no, this is not, different spelling though. I'm just like, no, this is.
Oh, the other. Wait, yeah. The Kathy?
Yeah.
I-E?
Sorry?
O-C? C-A-T?
Yeah, yeah. My friend Kathy's. Oh. My friend Kathy's name starts with a C instead of a okay. K.
The one with the concert, right?
No, that's Kate.
Oh, what's wrong with you? Why are you getting all these Catherine type people?
Oh, and I had one of my next door neighbor for a few years in high school and into college was named Catherine. Yeah,
what's going on?
I don't know. It was just the streak ended years ago. So, I also had two friends named Vanessa. What is the probability of that actually happening to somebody? So, anyway, but no, but yeah, I think there's just a lot of complicated emotions wrapped up in it.
Yeah,
and I think Ruth kind of sees that and takes advantage of it.
Yeah. I do want to talk about Ruth. Initially, my question was, I texted you at one point and said, my patience with Ruth is wearing thin, which is probably, even though I said I'd like, you know, a POV from Ruth, I think that I would actually hate being in that POV because of how annoying it would be. Initially, I asked a question on this document, you know, do you consider her a good friend? But I think maybe that's like too simplistic. But do you consider her a friend at all in like any aspect of how you would define the word friend to Kathy and Tommy specifically? That's, and you can broaden it if you would like to talk about her character.
Yeah, because she's, I apologize for using this word, but I can't think of any other word. She's really bitchy to them. And it is, you know, but they're very emotionally immature too. So it gets a little bit of a pass. I think on some level they are friends. I think she considers herself a friend to them. whether or not, but I think that the energy that they would put out in a friendship toward her is not necessarily reciprocated on the same level, right? You know, so yeah. it's an uneven balance. It's, you know, it's unbalanced. And so, but I think that she would consider herself part of their group and being companions to them on some level, because they do end up in the same place quite a bit. And Kathy does care for her, and then literally care is her carer. And of course, you know, Tommy, she has this relationship with, but it, with all the complicated emotions there, I think it's also her immaturity and her, you know, maybe just to psychoanalyze her a little bit, it's kind of a defense thing. Mm. You know, she is the one who, after when they're in Norfolk, just has that moment, which if you come to that realization, or that's the conclusion you reach, right? That, like, you know, they didn't clone us from regular people. They cloned us from a bunch of criminals and prostitutes and et cetera. I think she uses the word prostitute at one point. That's gotta be pretty crushing, yeah. Right? To think that, like, you know, here, we're going to clone the dregs of society.
Yep.
As long as they're healthy enough and don't have genetic disorders, because all we need is these people's organs, right? We're harvesting people are not human to us. And when she's putting it together, she reacts with anger in a way that it tracks with how her character had been, because her character had been kind of mean and manipulative and always wanted what she wanted and stuff like that. And then, it actually makes sense that she's the one to reach that conclusion and then have it, you know, I don't even know if she knows how to react to that either.
Yeah. Yeah. Lots to suss out about this. So initially it's complex. I do not think that this is a yes or no answer necessarily, which is why I took back the, is she a good friend? I think friends are flawed. We make mistakes. You know, I've made mistakes against you, Tom. You know, and we apologize and we move on, that sort of thing. So, because there's some wonderful moments that they have, you know, her with the cassette tape that's lost, because Ruth goes out of her way to look for this and is asking different people, and so that scene's really beautiful. You know, talking to her and everything, but it's an interesting society, which we'll talk about the group. I think I have a question about the group. Yeah, it's the next one. In fact, Jay, that it's like a shunning society. You know, Ruth can easily shun someone. She seems to be somewhat a queen bee in their class, but later in the cottages, she's very much a follower and wants to be with the people and have clout. I would say Kleos almost. So I guess I can't put my finger on why she does some of the things that she does. I think part of it is jealousy. And also she wants these people individually, like, for herself. Like, she wants Kathy for herself. She wants Tommy for herself. Because the whole sex, like, shaming Kathy for her sexual urges was really mean.
Oh, yeah.
And then, you know, you get these apologies years later, but Kathy had probably been living that entire time thinking that she, you know, was messed up. And even though Tommy said, like, I too get those urges, you know, that wasn't as helpful because, you know, he was a guy. So, yeah, it's just hard because she has these wonderful moments, but then when she's mean, like, it's really mean. And I don't necessarily know where this comes from. I don't know if it's similar to what Kathy says to Tommy at the end. You know, I wonder if you were lashing out because deep down you knew. Is that similar to Ruth, that deep down you knew that, you know, the reality of everything, and so this is why you are choosing to behave this way? I am unsure. Is it just a kid being a kid, you know, and not necessarily having adults guide in that way? Because the adults necessarily, we're not necessarily having heart-to-hearts in, like, you should treat your person like this.
No.
They were educating them, but not, like, how to relate to different humans. So that's not as helpful. Yeah, a complex character, but just, and perhaps she needed to be a foil to Kathy, just kind of be the opposite. And we always are attracted to someone, perhaps, who is big and, you know, bigger than life. And so that's why Kathy kind of is attracted to Ruth in that way. But I'm glad, because it's just like Kathy gets beat up a lot. And so I'm glad that she finally walked away and went to be a carer, even though it wasn't the best resolution of that situation. But Ruth puts her in bad situations. And because Kathy wants to still be in Ruth's good graces, she goes along with it, and she'll hurt Tommy in order to do that. So it's just, I almost a toxic friend. I don't know. Like, yeah, I would, if I were teaching these people, definitely Ruth needs to be in counseling of some sort, but I would probably be talking to Kathy, be like, this person's probably not the best person to be in your life, you know, if they're being like this to you. So a friend at times, she can be a great friend, but all times a devastating friend.
Yeah. Well, and there's time, like, this is, you think of the age when they're doing this, and then you think of years later when Kathy and Ruth have kind of patched things up, after some absence from each other, from what I gathered. That works really well too, because, you know, when you're in your 20s, especially into your 30s, like, you start to hit your threshold for other people's BS, like, lowers, right? And no, it's like, so she'll pull it up with Ruth, because in her mind, you know, like, yeah, she wanted her approval, you know, like, and all those things. The same way Ruth wanted the approval of, like, the couple that they were traveling with, the older kids. She wanted to be validated that she was as cool as them, as in a sense, right? But then, like, by the time they meet up again, you could tell that they both have changed and grown. And I don't think they would have been able to have the conversation that they have at the end of Ruth's life if they were still, like, 17 or something, right? But yeah, Ruth is, he really writes this relationship between two girls / women very realistically, because seeing similar dynamics, you know, where somebody takes way too much and the other person is like, okay, you can have it. And eventually they might reach a breaking point where it's like, wait, what is going on here? Like you said, somebody pulled them aside, or they came to the realization on their own, which sometimes never happens, you know, but yeah. So, and I liked the assertion you made, like, where she said that on a subconscious level, like, you knew what was happening and this is your way of acting out or dealing with it or whatever, in the same way why Tommy had emotional outbursts. Because before you find out, like, what the school is, you kind of wonder if Tommy's just, like, autistic or something. Like, you know, that he has that, you know, not, and I mean it in a pejorative sort of way, but, like, you know, the emotional outbursts, the regulation, the way they kind of, the other kids make fun of him. And then there's they don't coddle him, but there's sort of a treatment of him being a little more special than the other people. It does come off as that sort of thing. And then you see, I mean, who knows, it might've been the case as well anyway, but then you see what really is going on, and you're like, yeah, I think on some level he knows what's going on too, and this is his way of acting out against it. It's fascinating. They all end up having distinct personalities despite being raised in this bubble.
Yeah, and being clones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I do want to talk about the sex that happens.
Okay.
And I guess as a theme, and the porn magazine, and Kathy with the porn magazine, and kind of the revelation of why she was doing that. So sex is, it's like, I would say, super normalized. The only thing that the people say, well, there are a couple of things that the instructors, the guardians say to the children, I guess. It was hard to get an idea of when they started these talks.
Uh-huh.
So they don't have, as far as I know, reproductive organs.
Yeah, I think they're in. I assume that they were just infertile.
Okay.
That they were either if they had they that they did not have they're not being harvested for that.
Gotcha. So they tell them to basically practice safe sex in the sense of don't be with someone that has a sexually transmitted infection. Wait, what is it called?
Yeah, STD, STI, yeah.
And also that it can get tricky when feelings are involved. So they do kind of warn about that. Start, like I said, early. So this is before the cottages. So that is sub 16, which I'm not saying there's like not a too soon a time to start talking about sex necessarily, but almost immediately, kids are trying to find areas in order to go have sex. Kathy trying to get rid of her virginity is a, which I don't even think that they refer to it as that. It's just like trying to have her first time, I think is the only way it's referred to. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure virginity did not pop up as
I
a
don't
term.
remember seeing the word, but I.
Which is interesting all in itself. She was, yeah, trying to have her first time with somebody, and then a Tommy thing happened, and I thought, oh, what's this Tommy thing? But no, false alarm. She ends up having her first time in the cottages. As I said, so she has these urges, like she basically, I mean, she's horny, and she wants to have sex. I mean, that's basically what's happening here, and she's shamed for it. And then there are porn magazines that kind of make their way around. They're called Somebody Stash, whose name I cannot recall, Steve Stash or something like that. And people feign disinterest when they're reading them, but then, inevitably it'll disappear. So lots of like things to discuss. What are your thoughts on the role of sex in this novel, I think, is my one question. And then while it's connected, it is really a completely different talking point. But that whole scene and the revelation of why Kathy with the porn magazine and Tommy being there and then later being brought up, I think in Norfolk, it was really when everything is revealed after Kathy, after Ruth goes on her tirade about, trash being, we're cloned from trash. Your thoughts on all of that, those scenes with the porn magazine.
He actually really accurately portrays horny teenagers. I mean, if you think about it, and the you were just the way you were describing them, like I'm not really interested. I found dad's Playboys, right? Or whatever. And I'm not really interested, and then all of a sudden, like I'm looking at the centerfold, and that's pretty realistic from my experience as a teen, as an adolescent, where like somebody's older brother had a Penthouse magazine and you didn't want to make it look like you were totally perving over the fact that there were naked women in the magazine doing various things. But eventually, like you took another look, another look, another look. And like, because you were interested, you just didn't want to admit it yourself because you've been told it was dirty, right? And they were given the matter of fact things about sex and told it could be emotionally troubling. But even then, you saw those mores about, what's clean, what's dirty, and the shaming that Ruth gives to Kathy and stuff like that. So I thought he really knew how they would think in that sense. And that they, and it also, again, it's also just attaches itself. We were talking about, are these people human or do they have a soul? It kind of adds to the proof of that. Why would they even seek out sex if they are just being harvested for organs? And so that does kind of add to the proof that these are actual people and this is the cruel world in which they're brought into. Can you remind me of what Ruth reveals? She says she has the tirade about being cloned from somebody trash, right? And does she say that it's very likely that Kathy's possible is in one of those porno mags? I'm trying to remember what she
She
says
doesn't
that is so awful.
specifically say that, but she does mention like prostitutes and things like that. Page 166.
Okay, I think we have the same edition.
Yeah. Let's see. We all know it, so why don't we all face it? We're not modeled from that sort. And Kathy says, Ruth. I cut in firmly. Ruth, don't. But she just carried on. We all know it. We're modeled from trash. Junkies, prostitutes, winos, tramps. Convicts, maybe, just so long as they aren't psychos. That's what we come from. We all know it, so why don't we say it? A woman like that? Come on. Yeah, right, Tommy. A bit of fun. Let's have a bit of fun pretending. That other woman in there, her friend, the old one in the gallery, art students. That's what she thought we were. Do you think she'd have talked to us like that if she'd known what we really were? What do you think she'd have said if we asked her? Excuse me, but do you think your friend was ever a clue model? She'd have thrown us out. We know it, so we might as well just say it. If you want to look for possibles, you want to do it properly, then you look in the gutter. You look in rubbish bins. Look down the toilet. That's where you'll find where we all come from.
And she's pretty nasty to Kathy in the 167, because like everybody else is like, you know, we're going to go off and you're going to go off here, and Kathy doesn't want to go with them. And she says, there's no reason we've got to go around together the whole time. If little Miss here doesn't want to join us, she doesn't have to. Let her go off by herself. And then she leaned over to Christy and said in a stage whisper, that's always the best way when Kathy's in a mood. Leave her alone and she'll walk it off. Tommy stays, but really it's just, yeah, it's her, like her, all of that is coming out and again and everything. And it's just, it's a pretty devastating moment, to be completely honest. It doesn't get swept under the rug, but I think they seem to do their best to forget it or ignore it as they go on, or we don't really get how much of an effect it has on the characters other than Ruth.
Now later on page 180, you know, Tommy said, when Ruth said what she did earlier on and I saw how upset you looked. Leave it, Tommy. I'm all right about it now, and I'm not going to bring it up with her when she gets back. No, that's not what I was getting at. He took his weight off the car, turned and pressed a foot against the front tire as though to test it. What I meant was, I realized then when Ruth came out with all that, I realized why you keep looking through those porn mags. Okay, I haven't realized. It's just a theory, another of my theories. But when Ruth said what she did earlier on, it kind of clicked. But I still don't really get it, Kath. Even if what Ruth says is right, and I don't think it is, why are you looking through old porn mags for your possibles? Why would your model have to be one of those girls? I shrugged, still not looking at him. I don't claim it makes sense. It's just something I do. There were tears filling my eyes now, and I tried to hide them from Tommy, but my voice wobbled as I said, if it annoys you so much, I won't do it anymore.
Yeah, then she says, okay, there's no sense in it. We all do it, don't we? We all wonder about our model. After all, that's why we came out here today. We all do it.
And she connects it with her sexual desires. She says, all right, Tommy, I'll tell you. It may not make any more sense after you've heard it, but you can hear it anyway. It's just that sometimes, every now and again, I get these really strong feelings when I want to have sex. Sometimes it just comes over me, and for an hour or two, it's scary. For all I know, I could end up doing it with old Keffers. It's that bad. That's the only reason I did with Huey and with Oliver. It didn't mean anything deep down. I don't even like them much. I don't know what it is, and afterwards, when it's passed over, it's just scary. That's why I started thinking, well, it has to come from somewhere. It must be to do with the way I am. So I thought if I find her picture in one of those magazines, it'll at least explain it. I wouldn't want to go and find her or anything. It would just, you know, kind of explain why I am the way I am. And Tommy does say I get it too sometimes. So part of it is like a lack of education from the Guardians. Yeah. They just kind of told them surface level stuff. And then Ruth, which I don't know if she knows more, but she just decides to hop on that and make her feel shame. And then it gets worse. She's the one who basically is making Kathy look in the porno magazines, because she made her think that in the first place. Yeah. So I like how sex is. Yeah, you're right that it is just a bunch of horny teenagers. I think it's pretty normalized, and it is a human experience and an intimate experience. So I think it's one more reason why, you know, these aren't just clones, but they're actually humans. But it also shows the sadness of the situation, the fact that they can't get pregnant. I mean, obviously, you know, they're kids, so they might not want to there, but just in the future, you know, that's not even a possibility for them, because that's just, they won't even live that long. So there's a sadness with that as well. But yeah, the porn magazine was very interesting, especially in regards to Kathy and everything.
There's a little bit of Brave New World in this aspect of the novel, because if you've been, it's been a couple of years
since I read. Orgy.
Yeah, the whole idea that sex in Brave New World is all for pleasure because they're growing everybody in a lab because it's you know, it's, there's the eugenics element of it. And he might be kind of pulling from that a little bit and creating this dystopia. But she's also like, so she's curious, she's doing this. They have this, like, yeah, you're right, this clinical, even surface level knowledge of it. They really didn't educate them very well about it. And she's almost scared of her own sexuality.
Yeah.
Where she's like, I have these urges. Like, she sounds terrified when she's talking about it because she thinks there's something wrong with her. And, like, it's kind of dramatic the way she puts it. But, and then the idea that, like, she just connects that to, well, maybe my possible was a porn actress or something, because who else would think about sex this way or have these urges for sex? And it shows how, for all of their efforts to make these children feel human, mm-hmm. or whatever, they messed them up just as much.
Yeah. Alas. Well, talking about more teenage angst and behaviors, one of the most notable aspects of life at Hailsham and later the cottage is the power of the group. Students watch each other carefully and try on different poses, attitudes, and ways of speaking. And I should also say that the TV is influential as well. Mm-hmm. Is this behavior typical of most adolescents, or is there something different about the way the students at Hailsham seek to conform? And is this why there are no places that are private, because people are always wanting to watch other people and what they're up to?
On some level, this is very much teenagers, right? Even down to the getting catchphrases off of TV shows, you know, and walking around saying, repeating lines from a show. I mean, kids still do that, you know. I don't know how much, I don't know what you've had to hear versus what I've had to hear this year. I think the skibbity toilet has kind of had, it really didn't get to where I was, my ninth graders. And then I remember at one point one of my students, I don't remember what it was, made a reference to something that was, you know, it's one of those things where, like, here's a term and it's actually sexual. You're trying to get your teacher to you know, you're trying to, like, you know, make your teacher look like an idiot for, like, because they were repeated or whatever. And I just, like, shut her down with it. But, you know, back when I was in high school, we were parroting lines from the MTV sketch show The State all the time, as well as, like, Saturday Night Live and those sorts of things. And if you observe me and my wife long enough, you will get a fair amount of Simpsons reference in our dialogue back and forth to one another, in just, like, little bits and pieces and things like that. So I think that's just, it's very, very, I actually kind of like how he had that, because they picked the things up from TV, and they also picked things up from each other. I mean, like, you hang around with a group of people enough, you're not a total chameleon, but you do pick up what the group does, and you will act. I mean, in linguistics and culturally for, people of color, especially black people, it's referred to as code switching, right? You know, the idea that you will act differently among different groups of people and stuff. So there's a little bit of that going on. But yeah, I thought, again, like, he gets the dynamics and group things for this really well in a science fiction novel, because he feels that he doesn't need to always have a scientific or fantastical explanation for their behavior, because he's just showing that they're people. And he has layered this tragedy on top of it that is just makes it really, really sad.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, it's like a little, well, I guess it's a
like boarding schools.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much a boarding school, and mm-hmm. it's a small little pond. And even though there are multiple classes, you don't necessarily get a sense of how the classes interact vertically.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it seems like a microcosm of the real world, and as also at what we experience in schools and social situations and things like that. But because they don't experience the outside world, they just take on what they think might be appropriate for the outside world. Because yeah. I certainly, when I leave a room, don't be tapping somebody else's arm. Let them know that I'm going. Yes. And then, yeah, the watching, like there's no safe place.
Ugh.
I just don't know. This is the one thing that I'm just not sure. It made it Hailsham seem claustrophobic.
Yes.
And also a bit sinister, especially because of those tales. Like you couldn't go. There were some forbidden areas.
Mm-hmm.
There was the rumor of a couple people dying because they like crossed a fence and didn't come back. So yeah, you try to talk and it can be heard. It can be heard across the water, other places. People are always watching you. It's very much like a Big Brother situation.
Yeah. Yeah. And then everybody's always around each other because they're in those close quarters. It's like having a bunch of siblings who are all up in your business, you know? And yeah, so it's just kind of amplified that way, which is why they have those little special places that they find, right?
How do Madame and Miss Emily react to Kathy and Tommy when they come to request a referral? Defending her work at Hailsham, Miss Emily says, "Look at you both now. You've had good lives. You're educated and cultured. What is revealed in this extended conversation, and how do these revelations affect your experience of the story?"
Madame was the one in the wheelchair at that point, right? And Emily was not. No, it was the other way around.
Yep.
Okay. Because I know one of them was kind of... There was a little tension between the two of them when it came to this. And Emily seems to have... I don't know. Like, it's almost naive the way she says that. You know, like, look... Or her trying to, like, almost, like, convince herself that she did the right thing. You know what I mean? Like, it's not even for them. It's for her that she says, look at you. You've lived lives and things like that. I mean, it's essentially revealed, you know, in this extended conversation, they reveal a lot about the, I know they reveal a little bit more of the backstory and the history and stuff like that. And it makes it even sadder, you know, mm-hmm. because again, there are these little bits and pieces of hope in the novel, and this was like one of the last ones. In fact, this is 261 and there's what, 288 pages. This is right at the end of the book, and I think right after this Tommy is like very close to when Tommy is like, all right, I don't need you to be my carer anymore, and they kind of break up. Yeah, it's almost like she's, I don't even know if she's even heaping praise on them, and she's just kind of saying that to justify what they did and convince herself that she was right all along or something. I think it's kind of it's almost like she's being more selfish about it than she realizes.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Yeah, because this rumor keeps popping up and, you know, it's not true. And I think that people find out that it's not true potentially, or just can't get enough information in order to get to Madame and figure it out. I think it does show that just hope continually, you know, shines through even in bad situations. And it sometimes comes from a very shocking place, you know, it just like originates somewhere, like ex nihilo, which I find both beautiful as well as sad. Because this very much does affect their relationship towards the end there. Yeah. She explains everything so matter of fact. Like, she's definitely not caring in how she explains everything at the end, which is unfortunate. She's knowing, you know, when she, you're here about the deferral. You know, it's like, she knows all about it. But I wish that she were a bit more gentle in the landing, but she was just worried about having the dresser be unharmed, it seemed like, that entire time. And as if, you know, the other stuff is makes up for it, you know, that you're going to die. But hey, you know, we took care of you. You weren't abused. And you know some stuff. So maybe it equals out. It's hard to say. Yeah. Let's see how what is revealed, how these revelations affect your experience of the story. I mean, it's unfortunate. I mean, it really, your heart takes a dip after that because you're thinking, oh wow, could Tommy and Kathy be together for 4 years without any more surgeries? And then you're like, no. And this is probably the end of that relationship. And then you look back at everything else, you know, Chrissy and Rodney. I think that was his name. And yeah, just the countless generations. And I don't know if it'll pop up again, but Hailsham's done because everyone thought it was a Hailsham specific thing. So I don't know if now that that's gone, that deferrals don't exist anymore. But and is there any hope? That would be my next question is, okay, if this is no longer the hope, what other kind of hope might there be?
There might be something somewhere, but for these characters, there isn't. It's why they just kind of resign themselves to their fate at the end.
Yeah.
One thing he didn't do in the book that I appreciated was have them try to find the school. It's mentioned.
Oh, re yeah.
She thinks I see it sometimes, or I can picture it, but it's not like they go to see the boat because they've heard this thing about it, and it's almost like kids, like, let's go see this cool looking thing, but they don't go searching for Hailsham, which I was like, actually liked that
Yeah.
about the novel. I think that it's the last shred of hope. Then they kind of have to accept who they are,
Yeah.
and unfortunately it's just sad, it's bleak.
Yeah.
This entire novel, I picture the entire time that the weather is always cloudy. Like, I do not picture, I know at one point she mentions where they are, where the sun comes out, and I was like, wait, what? Because of the entire book, I'm picturing partly cloudy, at least in the days after Hailsham. And Hailsham, I can kind of see, like, you know, this very pretty looking school and everything, like an English country estate or something, like, you know, something like really, really bucolic. But once they're in the present, so to speak, right? Or after the Hailsham days, when they're in the cottages and then the caring facility, all I picture is cloudy days. And I think that just matches the mood of everything that happens.
Yeah. I will say that in regards to not finding Hailsham again, I think it's very similar to that quote, you can't go home again. Because I think that, yeah, I don't know, there'd be
They
like a
seem weirdly
dissociation there.
accepting of it too, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a pass there. Does the novel examine the possibility of human cloning as a legitimate question for medical ethics, or does it demonstrate that the human costs of cloning are morally repellent and therefore impossible for science to pursue? What kind of moral and emotional responses does the novel provoke? If you extend the scope of the book's critique, what are its implications for our own society?
I think this is where some of the things we're talking about Frankenstein come in too, because of the nature of creating life from something else and what are the moral implications of that. I don't know if he's making a statement or not, at least on whether or not cloning is right. I think he might be making a statement about how we operate as a society by just projecting or extrapolating, like, what would happen if this existed? Because I think that's, like, very, very true. It's almost like he's looking at the sociological aspects of it as opposed to the medical ethics side of it. At least that's what some of the readings that I'm getting as I was going through it, because I was just thinking about, like, you know, there's a lot said about how they are all outcasts and what directions they're pushed in by what society wants out of them, and essentially society is like out of sight, out of mind. You know, even though you could not tell if somebody was a clone, right? But even then, yeah. So I think that as far as the morally repellent question and impossible for science to pursue, I think that the response that we would have to it on some level do make it repellent, because how could you treat somebody like that and such? I don't think he's stating anything about cloning specific parts of the human. you know, if you could figure out a way to clone a human heart that would work and you could use that for a transplant. I don't think he's making a statement about this here. I think he's making a statement about cloning people specifically. I think he just sees like this would not work because of the way we as a society are. So he's critiquing society rather than, in my mind, sometimes he's critiquing society more than he's actually critiquing the act of the cloning.
Yeah, because I think it's whatever the purpose is behind the cloning, which mm-hmm. of course is defined by the society, or yeah. it's whatever the societal needs are, and then how those clones are being treated. So again, a societal issue. So we don't need the perfect human race. So
that yeah, that's going too far, right?
Yeah. And then what are we, is this really what we're doing? And, but to be honest, this stuff actually exists in real life, not as clones, but people having children because they already have a sick child. And so their secondary child is being used for, you know, the blood, the marrow, that sort of thing, which is what Jodi Picoult. What is that called?
My Sister's Keeper.
That is correct.
Yes.
Like that's,
right. I read that a long time
yeah,
ago.
Yeah. It's terrible ending.
Yeah.
Maybe really angry.
I hated the end of that book.
Yeah. It was awful. Awful yeah. people. But obviously that's fictional, but that kind of stuff happens. So I felt a lot of that. So we're kind of doing it. But you are treating that person, that child, that sibling, as if they are just a donor.
Yeah.
Like, because you're just getting the marrow and that, yeah. that sort of thing. Yeah. So I would agree that you, I think he's more critiquing yeah. society rather than cloning, because cloning can be helpful, but what are you doing with the things that have been cloned? Mm-hmm. And then what is the purpose behind the cloning?
Creating a clone army.
Ooh!
For the Grand Republic. The scientifically wise, speaking though, and I think about it, I don't think they really go into the specifics of what they're donating. I mean, we know what they're donating, like the order in which they donate things. What do they take first? What do they take second? Because they complete after, a lot of them complete after their fourth. So is there something you cannot live with or that debilitates you so much? And that's what they take upon a fourth donation. Like, you know, there's no order of operations here. Like, is it marrow and things like that at the start? Is it a kidney? Is it some of your... it would be reproductive organs because they're is it a lung? Like, you know, like how much are they taking from you to the point where the fourth donation they've taken so much that you actually may not survive? The idea that some of their donations don't go very well the first couple of times, they complete a little early, so to speak, also is really, really well done, because yeah, that's a very complicated procedure and there's easily complications that result from that. So, but yeah, so I was kind of curious, is like, what are they taking first?
Yeah. The teacher, Miss Lucy Wainwright, wanted to make the children more aware of the future that awaited them. Miss Emily believed that in hiding the truth, we were able to give you something which even now no one will ever take from you. And we were able to do that principally by sheltering you. Sometimes that meant we kept things from you, lied to you, but we gave you your childhoods. In the context of the story as a whole, is this a valid argument?
This is tough,
yep.
because I can see how it is, but at the same time, it makes me angry.
Yeah.
Because, you know, how much do you shelter a child from the world, you know, and how, when does it become that you're actually doing something that's more toxic than you realize? And again, when Emily talks that way, I feel like you're just saying it to make yourself feel better and absolve yourself of any guilt in this situation. At the same time, Lucy says what she says out of frustration and such, and she kind of cracks, right? The dam bursts and things like that. And you know, I think the right approach is somewhere in between. That there's a you're not gonna go into great detail of how your kid's grandfather passed away if the kid's five. If the kid's 16 or 17, you are going to be give him a little more detail So you handle it at different ages. But so I see what you mean is we gave you a childhood, but at the same time, at what cost? And Lucy, who actually had a lot of compassion for these kids, but was kicked out or left voluntarily or basically thrown away in that regard, because pushed away because that's not how they thought the empathy should work. But like, she actually is as tough love as it seems. She's actually probably the more compassionate adult around them.
It is, yeah, I liked this question because of our professions as educators. I think that before they left Hailsham, they should have been made aware of everything. 16, I think that they would have had enough cognitive evolution. I don't know, cognitive growth and maturity to begin to consider these things. And then they would have had a couple years at the cottages to really process and potentially their thesis that they were writing slash not writing, could have been something about that. I do think, I mean, this goes back to our discussions regarding banned and challenged books about, sheltering children, protecting the children, think of the children. And then, when do you not? And I think as long as you are, this is hard stuff, right? So you're not going to tell a first grader that your greater purpose is that you're going to die. Your organs will be harvested. You might make it to two. Three is unlikely, and four, you probably won't make it past. You're not going to necessarily do that, but I think they knew of these terms, but weren't connecting it. But I think at the end, you kind of do that. And the fact that I brought up the banned and challenged books is we are. Hopefully, I'm speaking for you, but I think that we've talked about this before. Our thought is that you have these tough books that are cha just be with the child, read the child, read with a child or young adult, and have conversations and ask them questions and have them ask you questions about it so that. It's not, you're not just like having it sit there and then they have to figure stuff out on their own, which I will give a plug to Abbott Elementary. It took me many years to actually begin it. But there was a really great episode about banned and challenged books within their library. And one of the characters, Barbara, actually talks about that, like, read this with your child, talk with them. So I think, yeah, we're protecting the young ones, but I think when it's time, there's a switch that happens where protecting them and not telling them is detrimental to their safety and their well-being. I think one could use an allegory of sex ed, at like this, you could take this whole thing as an allegory, sex ed as an allegory for this book that people don't want to do it because they feel like this promotes having sex, and it's more like actually like where if you don't do it, then people are, who will probably inevitably have sex then are confused about things, and then you have pregnancies and you have assaults, and well, assaults. Obviously, blame should be had if someone doesn't know that they're necessarily like assaulting, which sounds odd, but I can give an example, but I feel like now is not the time. But just like if there's not education and someone doesn't realize like you're actually kind of pushing someone to do this and that that's technically assault, then that's an issue. So, sex ed, I think is helpful. You're just preparing them whenever that certain time happens. And so I think this is true, prepare them year 16 for when inevitably these donors would have happened. So I think there's a balance there. Okay, well, come to the end here. So this is the final paragraph of the novel where she goes back to Norfolk, I'm pretty sure.
She does.
Okay. I found I was standing before acres of plowed earth. There was a fence keeping me from stepping into the field with two lines of barbed wire, and I could see how this fence and the cluster of three or four trees above me were the only things breaking the wind for miles. All along the fence, especially along the lower line of wire, all sorts of rubbish had caught and tangled. It was like the debris you get on a seashore. The wind must have carried some of it for miles and miles before finally coming up against these trees and these two lines of wire. Up in the branches of the trees, too, I could see flapping about torn plastic sheeting and bits of old carrier bags. That was the only time, as I stood there looking at that strange rubbish, feeling the wind coming across those empty fields, that I started to imagine just a little fantasy thing, because this was Norfolk after all, and it was only a couple of weeks since I'd lost him. I was thinking about the rubbish, the flapping plastic in the branches, the shoreline of odd stuff caught about the fencing, and I half closed my eyes and imagined this was a spot where everything I'd ever lost since my childhood had washed up, and I was now standing here in front of it. And if I waited long enough, a tiny figure would appear on the horizon across the field and gradually get larger until I'd see it was Tommy, and he'd wave, maybe even call. The fantasy never got beyond that. I didn't let it. And though the tears rolled down my face, I wasn't sobbing or out of control. I just waited a bit, then turned back to the car to drive off to wherever it was I was supposed to be. What does the final sentence indicate about Kathy's state of mind as she faces her losses and her own death? Stoicism, denial, courage, resolution, question mark?
I think it's resolution and acceptance. Like, she's moved through all the stages of grief, in a sense, especially after Tommy. And she's still devastated by all of it, but she is accepting of what comes next and might not even be fearful of it anymore if she ever was to begin with. And this leaves you with this really sad feeling, even empty in a sense, because there's nothing else she can do, right? And that image, this childlike image, here are all the things that I used to have, and there's Tommy, is like, I mean, God, that's just one of the saddest images in the book, because it's just because she never lets it get past that point, because she knows that it's, she just knows that it's done, and why would I let it get past that point, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, gosh, it's so this book is so heavy at the end.
Very much is. I do like how it ends with that, though.
Mm-hmm.
Of those four options, I suppose feelings, resolution is also what I would fall on too. Mm-hmm. I think it is beautiful, even though we're talking about rubbish, which is interesting because the rubbish then turns into Tommy. So there's still that lingering thought from Ruth of, you know, are we cloned from rubbish? But because Norfolk is this thought, this place that all the lost things come and she has lost, you know, Tommy, that she gets to see him again. I feel like that's a beautiful moment for sure.
Yeah.
Heavy. I did forget one thing that I wondered, and I feel like I would kick myself if I didn't ask, because I think other people might wonder there as well. There were a couple of times in this novel I thought, what if Tommy and Kathy just left? They just, you know, checked out and they went somewhere. They went to some town and they were somehow able, obviously they probably don't have papers. I don't even know. Do they have IDs? But they just left, you know, they ran away. Why is it that they don't run away? Like they just kind of go along with everything. And this is true of anyone. I just said Tommy and Kathy, but we don't hear of anybody ever trying to leave, with the exception of the people, the rumors, the urban legends that left and then died out in the cold.
Yeah.
Any thoughts as to, I mean, is this, would that have been possible? Was that just something that they didn't think about? Because there is this, they love the film, The Great Escape.
Yeah.
So they recognize that escape exists as a concept, but don't necessarily connect that that's something they can do.
Yeah, this is not as a bleak dystopia as The Handmaid's Tale, where all Fred does, it seems escape at the end, but the idea of, like, how do I escape when you're so, like, it's such a claustrophobic novel, right? This is a little bit claustrophobic in places. I just think that, I don't know, they've just been conditioned in a sense. It's hard to explain other than thinking of, like, how you say you fantasize about getting out of something that you really don't like doing, but then you just get up and go to work the next morning anyway, or something. You know, like it's a human nature that we just kind of get stuck in our roles and stuff too. So it never really occurred to me that they could. And I don't think they do, partially I don't think they do, because I don't think it's what Ishiguro wanted them to do. This isn't a revolutionary story.
No,
you know, it's and that's actually one of the reasons I really like it. As horrifyingly sad as it is, I like the fact that they don't rise up against the system and expose things and everything. Other authors can do that. I don't think he needs to do that here, and I think he needs to show this angle too, because it's just as valid and it's just as worth contemplating and discussing. So yeah, I think they're just, they are essentially stuck, and they don't realize how stuck they are, you know, and even then maybe they're scared to leave mm-hmm. everything behind, because this is all they know, right? And you know, entirely now. What do you think?
Well, yeah, because I don't really envision anyone coming after them.
No.
If they were
not, I mean, it, you know? Maybe at first, but
yeah.
But after a while, like, there's got to be a point where there's anybody coming after them, if they really got away, would just give up.
Yeah.
You know,
it's almost, I guess, endearing, I suppose, that their greatest troubles are kind of the day to day. Mm-hmm. You know, and angst and drama between themselves, this is not even a consideration or something. Yeah. That's on the horizon, you know, that, oh,
yeah,
you know, we could just run away because the madam said that, or Miss Emily said that deferrals don't exist. But it is interesting. I did think of this a couple of times. It's like, could you go? 'Cause that one guy has his own flat, and I can't tell where Kathy lives. Kathy seems to just live in the hospitals of where she's visiting.
Yeah.
But that one friend, so if he rents a flat, they must have ID and some. I also didn't mm-hmm. understand the pay system. I wasn't sure how they were getting funds, because Kathy was able to get things for her donors. So there were many questions that I had,
yeah.
But I think it was possible, but it just wasn't on their purview.
I would imagine that as far as housing is concerned, yes, she said the hospital, or there is some sort of dormitory or something set up for carers within that system to ensure that they have a place to be so that they can do their jobs. You know, if you're thinking, if we're running it through like I don't know if it's called the NIH over in Britain or whatever the healthcare system is that, you know, the socialized medicine is. If they're just running it through that bureaucracy, then there is probably, you know, there might be the option to live on your own independently, and there's probably a pay system or something that I think just you can kind of just assume. You know, I don't know if you need to see how the wheels work. It's just it's the government, so they're paying for it in some way.
Yeah,
that's kind of how I view it. Grants. Something, I don't know, but the system is set up to make sure that the system runs, and if they see that the carers need food, shelter, and clothing and money, they will give what they need to be able to do the job that they're contracted to do.
So Never Let Me Go was published 20 years ago, and there's a question that I've been asked over and over again. Why don't the characters, given that they're living in a kind of a pretty dystopian world, why don't they rebel, or why don't they just escape? Now, this really seems to bug people. And for a long time, I used to think this was a weakness of the book. But as the years have gone by, I've started to think that this is part of the reason this novel has lasted and has, to some extent, haunted people. When I was writing the book, I was very aware that there was a huge bunch of blockbuster movies, great novels, that addressed the question of human rebellion against oppressive, authoritarian, or other systems. Sometimes it ends badly, in 1984, say, and sometimes the rebellion is glorious. But I wasn't so interested in that kind of narrative. What fascinated me was the extent to which, in the world outside of books and films, people didn't rebel, they didn't protest. Usually what happens is that people
accept the hand that they've been dealt and try to make the best of it. I mean, throughout history, people have remained in terrible marriages. They've done awful jobs all through their lives. Millions of people throughout history worked in ghastly mines or factories, including small children. Millions of people worked and died as slaves. Many, many people over the years fought in wars that they didn't believe in or didn't understand anything about. The fascinating thing for me is the way people respond to being dealt a really bad hand. And sometimes it seems to me that if that's all you know, if that's the world you've grown up in, you cannot see the boundaries for which you have to run. You cannot see what you have to rebel against. And instead, you just try, sometimes heroically, to find love, friendship, something meaningful and decent within the horrific fate that you've been given. So that's the only answer I can usually offer when people say, why don't the characters in Never Let Me Go run away?
Okay, well, Tom, do you believe that this is required reading?
Yes, I really do. It is amazingly written. It is so sad. It is a book that will wreck you emotionally. But I really do think this is required reading because it's just because of the way it stays with you and the way it explores some of these things from angles that other books like this don't always approach.
Yeah, and I think, like I said, if you had an English class and you're doing Frankenstein, I think it would be interesting to pair this with that and have similar themes discussed, but a different angle and different science fiction. So absolutely. Yeah, but prepare yourselves, I guess, as you read this, which, I mean, you're listening to this, so you've been spoiled. But also, if you decide to see the film, just know that in some ways, I think that the film is worse emotionally than the book. So prepare yourself with that.
All right. So we do not have feedback, at least for this episode. Will any episode feedback that we got for the last couple will throw into episode 104. So please get your emails and all that coming and your Facebook comments and messages and stuff. We always do appreciate them. But I guess it's time for me to reveal what we're doing next.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going old school. I'm going with something going English class standard on my reread list and going with something that is like one of the great American novels in the American canon, partially because I've been meaning to do this novel for years, partially because it just turned 100. So strap in, kids, because next month we're talking about The Great Gatsby.
Wow, you finally pulled the trigger.
Finally pulling the trigger on the... Well, okay. Spoilers with Gatsby. We're finally pulled the trigger on Gatsby.
I know you don't like her, but you'll play Lord's Green Lights?
Sure. I don't know if I've heard that song in a while.
No.
If I'm being completely honest with you. So I'm kind of ambivalent on Lord. All right, but that's it. As always, thank you very much for listening and take care.
And if someone decides to show you imaginary animals that they spend a lot of time on, I think you should be supportive of their artwork. And you also should not badmouth them behind their back because it will get back to them and it'll be very sad.
Hear, hear. Good night.
Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, which is brought to you by Two True Freaks. That's Two True Freaks. If you're interested in learning more about the books we've read or want to comment on the episode, follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/Required Reading with Tom and Stella.
If you would like to email us to comment on the episode or continue our discussion, you can reach us at requiredreadingcast@gmail.com. We will read every email we get on future episodes.
We're looking for more visibility, so if you liked this episode or the show in general, why not leave us a review in iTunes? Thanks again for listening, and come back next month for our next episode.